Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to another episode of America Trends, and we thank you for turning to us even in these difficult times. And from time to time, we will bring you special programming related to the coronavirus crisis that we are in the midst of here in America, and in fact, all across the globe. And like others, we really want to tip our hats to the medical first responders. We've always known of their skill and their acumen, but their bravery in the face of this invisible germ is truly remarkable. And if this illness and if this virus has affected you personally, and I think that's a growing number of us, our hearts go out to you in this difficult time. And we thank you for spending a few moments. We hope we can perhaps distract you and bring you to another topic today. And in the scheme of what's going on, perhaps this might not seem important. And in fact, even in normal times, we pay very little attention to what we're bringing to you. But it is a trend in America. Increasingly, we are being assessed with fees on government services and private services like our electric bills, our internet bills, our cable bills, and they may seem as if they're a nuisance, but when they're adding up to $1.46 trillion a year with very little regulation attached to them, they are of growing significance to all of us. And there was a man who saw this and began to really calculate the impacts in his book, Land of the Fee. Devin Fergus, PhD, he joins us today on America Trends.
With me on the line is Devin Fergus, a PhD. He is the Distinguished Professor of History and Black Studies at the University of Missouri and editor of Columbia University Press's Studies in the History of U.S. Capitalism. And the book that we are going to discuss today was considered to be one of the five best books for understanding capitalism today. And Devin Fergus, when I read this book, Land of the Fee, I said, you have hit a home run here. And just to point out and to personalize this topic, I brought out my electric bill and my cable bill. And all I see on these bills is fee upon fee. And it's almost like 1,000 cuts, $1.50 here, $2.50 there. What is going on with this practice?
Oh, you're absolutely right. And you have brought out your internet service provider fee like I did this weekend. You find even more fees. So fees are a way in which basically they're used to provide profit for the private sector and to help generate revenue for the public sector, without actually raising the ire as much or creating a public backlash or consumer backlash against the cost of a particular product or item. So fees used to be considered to cover administrative costs, but increasingly fees are seen as a stream of revenue or a stream of profit, and profit for the private sector and revenue for the public. So for my ISP, it's profit, and then for if you have a publicly regulated utility or a public or utility company, it's can generate revenue. And we I'm old enough to at least to remember the George H.W. Bush's presidency.
Yeah.
And he basically went in and said, "Read my lips, no new taxes."
Yeah.
And under his administration, taxes actually increased. And his political rivals, and actually in both parties, really pillory George H.W. Bush for ostensibly raising their taxes. And so no politician wants to stand up there and say, I'm going to increase or raise your taxes. And no company actually wants to come out and say, I'm going to increase or raise the cost. But they ended up doing that through these things of fees and fines, actually, ways in which they increase costs. And so even something like a hotel resort fee, and that's what they call a first world problem. You're staying at a nice and fancy hotel resort. But even now that Motel 6 has a hotel resort fee. So these fees are used to pad costs, to increase the revenue and profit stream for both the public and the private sort of sector.
Well, what I found interesting, your subtitle, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class, and you look at what politicians, economists, the media, they all look at wealth inequality, and they look at the loss of working class jobs. They look at tax policy decisions that benefit the very rich. And they focus on these macro issues, but by one fee after another, we are being driven all these categories that are so important to us, like housing, work, transportation, mm-hmm. schooling, loans, into debt, greater and greater debt because of these fees.
No, absolutely. Excellent point. The National Economic Council in December 2016 published a report talking about the growing trend of fees in the U.S. economy as a means to systematically transfer wealth. But the fees that actually the National Economic Council sort of looks at are really, like you said, utility fees or hotel resort fees or airline fees. My research looks at fees which are critical to upward mobility. So that's what my book looks at. And so, as I mentioned before, if you're paying a hotel resort fee, typically that's kind of like a first world problem. But I mean, the escalation of fees in critical areas of moving up the economic ladder, whether it's these hidden fees becomes mortgage lending, or the fees that you might experience in terms of access to college, or what I look at in terms of fees in terms of talks in terms of employment, and what takes us to home and school and work for anyone who lives west of the Hudson River, the automobile. And so fees in terms of transportation. And so in these four areas which are critical of mobility, housing, which you know is the primary, home ownership is the primary means in which wealth is generated in the U.S. economy for the majority of households, access to education as upper mobility, and then employment is critical and key, right? We all need jobs, employment, income of mobility. And so in all these areas are critical to moving up the economic ladder and sustaining or mobility in the middle class, we see the private sector flooding the marketplace with actual increased fees. And I'll just be frank, the declining sense of obligation, accountability from policymakers and lawmakers to rein in these fees, to regulate these fee generators.
Well, I want to get back to that because the growth of these fees has come about due partly, you say, to the increasingly complex and under-regulated financial marketplace. And again, we saw where Elizabeth Warren and others helping to set up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in the wake of what happened in 2007, 2008. I mean, we are looking for greater protections because it is such a complex world. We're so busy with work and commuting. We don't have time to read what is turned into a 30-page document instead of a one-page document. So we are outnumbered, outmaneuvered, and outgunned as a consumer.
Actually, right here, I'm taking a page out of my brethren in the private sector who go through from folks in the private sector, the private economy, who for really the past since World War II has been a sort of increasing outsourcing of employment and jobs. So and outsourcing is such a dirty word, and so but I mean there could be some use of outsourcing, and so the financial regulatory sort of actions needs in part to be outsourced. I mean, as you stated quite well and effectively and eloquently, we now have less time than our parents and grandparents did a generation or two ago. The average American is commuting longer distances. The average American is working longer hours, longer hours than almost any Western industrialized nation. And so where households now have less and less time, a financial context, as you said, is getting more and more complex. And so how do you square that sort of circle? And the way you sort of square it is outsourcing the policing and the regulatory or oversight of some of these financial transactions and consumer products to experts who know the area. I mean, so you outsource this stuff to regulators. Frankly, that's a part I think would be key and critical. But we've seen, as you mentioned, you know, the CFPB, Consumer Financial Bureau, and so which was again an important agency set up under the Dodd-Frank Act by Elizabeth Warren, and we've seen the systematic sort of erosion of the CFPB by its political opponents. And also to say this, this Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. In many ways, part of its origins was to do things like to help protect military service personnel who were seeing themselves really targeted by payday lenders who saw people in the military or military bases as sort of shooting fish in a barrel. They were typically youngish, fresh out of high school often, mm-hmm. Not much familiarity with keeping books and accounting and finance, but getting regular and steady paychecks from the federal government. And so the military personnel became a primary target. And we all, anyone who's done any sort of research in terms of economic security, national security, or military sort of history, understand the role that debt might play in creating vulnerable members within the military sort of personnel becomes a national security sort of clearance issue if an individual becomes too indebted or files for bankruptcy. And so the military really is the king subject on the military sort of radar. And so one of the reasons that the CFPB was created was to help to protect many of the military service personnel, I should say. But even that did not really do it for financial sort of sector or these payday lenders and some of their allies in both the state houses as well as in Washington D.C. And so when even the concerns about military service personnel doesn't rise to the concern of lawmakers and policymakers, I think all of us should feel quite vulnerable when even that class is not fully protected.
And so disgraceful, really, when you think about preying upon these military families. But now we're talking about all families in America, let's be honest. I mean, we're looking here, your book states, $1.46 trillion a year with all these add-ons to cable bills and electric bills and things that are necessities today in our society. And when you do look at it, you say, and this was one of the statements in the book that had me taken aback, that the cascading effects of fees are having lifetime and intergenerational consequences. Explain that to us.
First major expense that many consumers face, and this is, and I'm a historian by training, and so in the early part of the 20th century, that first major expense might have been the purchase of a home, right? Because so many Americans did not have access to post-secondary education. But today, that primary experience and encounter that many young people face, first experience they face, is really with access to college, applying for college and getting, assuming a student loan. And so student loans are really the second largest source of debt in America. They've exceeded sort of credit cards. And so here you have a student loan. It could be the average student loan is around probably a little over $30,000. And so that student loan over $30,000, it increases one's debt-to-income ratio. And what we know about debt-to-income ratio is that debt-to-income ratio is strongly correlated with a lower credit score. And what we know about lower credit scores is that the lower one's credit score is, the more likely one is to have to pay a premium, extras on one's mortgage. And so the increasing rise of the cost of student loans and the student loan debt has postponed home ownership for many Americans. So now on paper, when you apply for a student loan, on the document, the paper says that this loan needs to be paid off in 10 years. But the reality is that the actual student loan takes, for the average student loan borrower, takes closer to 20 years to pay off, not 10, takes twice as long. And in that window of time and that paying off that student loan, as I mentioned before, your debt-to-income ratio increases, which means that you're actually paying more for your mortgage loan if you're actually fortunate enough to be able to take out one. And so what was a 10-year student loan, as you take out a 30-year mortgage, expands the lifetime of almost that borrower. And so it increases that mortgage cost for the borrower for 10, 15, 20, even 30 or even 40 years. And that impacts, obviously, the disposable income, disposable wealth that young person in 2021 has to give to his kids when he's 20, when he's 30, 40, and 50. And it sort of extracts that wealth out of that household. And that money goes basically to these large financial institutions and these major international financial institutions.
Well, you also point out in the book that by the 2000s, the financial sector, you know, those middlemen who don't add a lot to the economy, I mean, they facilitate transactions, but they took 40% of all profits. Now, this replaced the manufacturing sector in many cases, which produced many more jobs and really had a productive element to it. But now it seems it must be the power of that financial sector, as large as it's grown, the army of lawyers and lobbyists that it controls, to be able to get these changes. And the other thing that I think strikes me, at least about reading your book, is that the public sector may be less willing and more reticent to control some of this because they're doing the same thing without raising taxes. They're raising fees, and they don't want us to notice that either.
Precisely right. And I love your use of the phrase middlemen or middle persons, because this is these intermediaries is precisely which drive up the cost of student loans. And I'm going to go back to that subject because you've really created this great sort of point to unpack with these middlemen, because we can see it vividly with the student loans and in the ways in which that middleman has a special interest, middle financial, so these credit intermediaries come in to really increase the cost. And so in the 1990s, the student loans were out there, the federal government said, hey, we have a great idea. Rather than having these middle financial men, these banks, these student lenders and these banks, rather than having those individuals sort of pay out the student loans, we're going to cut these middlemen out because the federal government was subsidizing these lenders. We're going to cut them out. We're going to give these student loans directly to the student loan borrower. And by cutting out the middleman, you actually reduce the cost of that financial sort of for the student loan. So that student loan was the cheaper financial product. It was delivered because the middleman was now removed. It was delivered quicker to the borrower. What we know is the cheaper a financial product is, the less likely the borrower is to default on a loan. And this is why it's important for everyone that if the student loan, the people left on the hook from the student loan is actually the taxpayer. The student that defaults on the loan that basically takes money away from the coffers, and the taxpayer has to cover that cost. And so here we have a financial product that's cheaper, the direct loan, and it's cheaper for the borrower, and also it's less likely to leave the taxpayer on the hook. But because of the private sector, the student lenders was cut out of the process, they protest, they provide deep kind of campaign funds and financing to lawmakers who, in response, bring these private lenders back into this system and create a more more expensive financial product in the student loan than what had existed. And so in the 1990s, student loans were supposed to be 80 to 90% of all the loans given out by 2000. That didn't happen. The direct student loan was actually capped at about 35 or 36%. That's the highest point in the mid-1990s. Mm. And that number declines and increasingly declines throughout the 1990s, creating a more expensive financial product for the student borrower, leaving the taxpayer potentially consequently on the hook, but giving nice kickbacks and money to the private sort of sector, extracting all this wealth. And I also mentioned before about the impact that this has on mortgage lending and these other aspects.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Absolutely. Devin Fergus is with us on America Trends, Land of the Fee. And in the book, you explain how the federal government, as you just described, used these origination fees in effect to subsidize these banks while imposing fees on students to balance the budget. I mean, some of these practices are usury. I mean, that's the only way you can describe them. And yet they are perfectly legal. And we see that in so many elements of financial transactions. One I had also read about, of course, the 401k fees that can be exorbitant. You know, everybody thinks they're getting free money from their employer and such. But when they go in and read the fine print in many of these retirement plans, they're getting charged exorbitant fees. And I know there was a fiduciary rule that was going to be implemented in the Obama administration. What has happened to that?
Sure, that's an excellent point, Larry. Yeah, that fiduciary rule has been tabled. I believe it was introduced by the Labor Department. And with the change of administrations, they've actually tabled the fiduciary rule. And this is important because the idea of a fiduciary is someone who has to be accountable, who has to be entrusted for handling one's financial assets in one's financial sort of portfolio with these retirement accounts. That was tabled sort of completely, and now we've reverted back to almost the sort of wild west in terms of retirement accountability, retirement sort of savings, retirement sort of spending. And I want to get back to to the point that you mentioned before about the rise of public fees mirroring what's happening in the private sort of sector. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. So, government not wanting to raise taxes has actually increased and ramped up the fee collection. And so I think from 1970 to the 2014, 2015, at least 75, 80% of all new government revenue growth came not from taxation, but from increasing fees and fines. And what tends to happen, Larry, is this, and we've actually seen it a lot since really the 70s and early 80s, because as you remove the regulatory apparatus, you experience as an economy more sort of economic sort of fluctuation, more boom and bust sort of cycles, almost like you have this sort of gilded sort of age. Particularly when a municipality experiences economic sort of downturn, i.e., the economy sort of goes to the tank, there's increasing unemployment or underemployment. There's a reduction of sales tax revenue. What happens with often municipalities do is they often increase the fees on a population. We see this in city after city, municipality after municipality. We see it in the aftermath of the Great Recession. Sales tax, sales receipts decline, and they ramp up fees. And this happens in municipalities all across America, most notably in municipalities in St. Louis. We see it happening in Chicago, where they're actually even breaking their own laws in Chicago in order to be so aggressive at fee collection. They're breaking their own laws in places like Chicago. They have a law in Chicago, municipality, violation of a code called a duplicate ticketing code. And, again, they violate that own code because they're so desperate to raise revenue in places like Chicago and elsewhere. And so the public sector fees have simply mirrored, often it's not driven what's happening in the private sector. These populations mirror one another.
And when we talk about all these hands in our pockets, and sometimes they're not terribly visible, they're not transparent, but you remind us, and I think this is really salient, that what changed, we've always had fees of one sort or another, but when it went from a means of offsetting some administrative costs or risks to, servicing, say, a loan or what have you, to a source of income in and of itself, these fees became a true profit stream. And as you said, sometimes it could hide. I mean, you didn't want to show a high interest rate, and so you wanted to be competitive, so you showed a low one, but all the fees really tacked on, added to all those costs, or you don't want to show that you're increasing taxes. So there is great incentive for private sector and public sector to assess fees rather than increasing other more visible costs.
No, absolutely right, and really see this thing taken off in the late 70s and early 80s. Absolutely right. As you said, Larry, these fees used to serve just to cover administrative costs, but the profitability has become so high that now it's used as a revenue sort of stream. And even let's take the subprime mortgage area where you have fees, the prepayment penalties, and the adjustable rate mortgage as an interest as a really part as a fee, the balloon payment sort of cost fee. Even these subprime mortgage loans become so profitable by the mid 2000s that these mortgage products, which were supposedly to be marketed to people with subcredit or stress credit, mm-hmm. would begin to be marketed to people with good credit, prime credit.
Who could get conventional loans.
Who warranted conventional loans, absolutely. Who deserve conventional loans. Why? Because of the profitability of these particular financial sort of products. And so you're absolutely right.
Well, I found it very interesting because you reminded us that as wage stagnation took hold in America for the last 20 or 30 years, we became more dependent upon borrowing. And when we at the same time deregulated these financial products, just at the time when we needed them most to live that middle class lifestyle, because the poor have always been trod upon by predatory practices. But when it started creeping into the middle class, it has gotten the attention, but not necessarily the action that's required to curb some of these excesses.
No, an excellent point. And you mentioned before about how these things are usurious in the petty lending industry is a sort of a classic example. And so they make a stated point to call what they're charging not interest, but call them fees, because the argument notion of an interest rate. Triggers often greater regulatory scrutiny at the state and federal level for usurious sort of practices, because many states have usury caps, interest rate caps on exorbitant lending. Those things are much murkier if something's labeled an actual fee. And so the payday lending industry often would much prefer they have their products and the costs and charges associated with them labeled as fees as opposed to interest in order to escape and elude sort of regulatory sort of police. Oversight.
Well, we are all on the receiving end of this activity, and I hope that our listeners now will become much more aware of it. What can we do as consumers? Because we, again, I said outnumbered, outmanned, outgunned. We have them on every pay slip that we have from every source that we need. I mean, how do we begin to push back on this? Is there any strong movement? Because we don't hear a lot about this. Thank goodness for your book, Land of the Fee. Tell us what we can do as consumers.
Well, Larry, I think you raised a very good point when you talked about and introduced the CFPB. Because I'll sort of say this in my research, there are obviously pockets of movements come up, but they're all about protecting individual sort of interests. And so something called a territorial radius system fee deals in auto insurance. A neighborhood pops up and says, this fee is awful, it's egregious, it's bad. I don't want you necessarily to change it, just changed my zip code because Treasury system fee is predicated on one's zip code. And so I'm not in that zip code, changed my zip code. And so what I would encourage your listeners to do is to look at supporting either by contacting your local Congress individuals, things like the CFPB, supporting the work they're doing, frankly, and encouraging them to actually be more aggressive, because there's been some rollback of the current leadership of the CFPB, so providing greater scrutiny for that. And in addition to, again, just for encouraging, supporting, and pushing the CFPB to be more aggressive in this regulatory sort of coverage and oversight, I also would encourage a meta policy encouragement. And by that I mean that, so in my research, what I've uncovered, regardless of whatever sphere I was looking at, is really the rise of financial interest in either creating these fees in the first place, or protecting these fees in the second place, or pushing back against the rollback of these fees in the third place. And there's always a financial sort of interest in shaping politics and policy. So what I would encourage is really supporting legislation like maybe the Anti-Corruption and Public Integrity sort of act, or the public financing of campaigns. And these bigger, broader things to try to drain the money that's needed in D.C. and that's pressed on lawmakers to shape policy. Because that's, in my research, that's what I see as a constant. Money shaping policy and political decisions, again, in the detriment of the consumer. And so that's in part what I would encourage as a meta sort of policy solution.
Well, thank you again for that and for this incredible book, Land of the Fee. You really need to read it. Devin Fergus, it has been our pleasure to have you on today on America Trends. Thanks again.
Same to you, Larry. Take care.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofit.